a finger drawn lightly down his cheek, rasping on the sandpaper of his beard, and then pushing lightly between his lips, making him turn his head for another gentle kiss, a mere touch of lips, and the mingling of their breath so that he could smell that peculiar perfume of passion from her mouth, a smell like newly dug truffles, a mushroomy, exciting smell. She saw the new spark of interest in his eyes and drew softly away to chuckle at him, a throaty, sensuous sound, and she drew one sharp fingernail swiftly down his spine so that little sparks of fire flew across his nerves and his back arched. "I am going to claw you because you deserve it, you randy old tomcat." She made a growly sound in her throat and curled her nails into a lion's claw, drawing it lightly across his shoulder, and then hard down his belly so that her nails left red lines against the skin. She studied the red lines, with her lips parted and the tip of her pink tongue touching her small white teeth. The nipples of her breast swelled as she watched, growing like new buds, as though they were about to burst. She saw the direction of his eyes, and she put her hand behind his head, drawing him down gently, pulling back her shoulder so that the heavy, rounded bosom was offered like a sacrifice. Mark took some of the big, scaly crayfish from the low-tide pools, and they smelt of kelp and iodine, thumping their tails furiously in his grip, snapping their legs and bubbling at the small mouths with their multiple mandibles. Mark rose, streaming salt water from the depths of the pool, and handed them up to Storm, who squealed with excitement on the rocky edge of the pool, and took them gingerly, using her straw hat as a glove against the spiky carapace and waving legs. Mark built a fire in a scooped fireplace in the sand, while Storm held John on her lap and fed him through a discreetly unbuttoned blouse, offering advice and ribald comment as he worked. He threw wet seaweed over the coals, put the crayfish on top of that, and covered them with another layer of seaweed, topping it off with a final layer of sand. And while they waited for the crayfish to cook, and John to finish his noisy guzzling, they drank wine and watched the setting sun turn the sea clouds into a brilliant display. God, nature's an old ham. If I painted like that, they'd say I had no sense of colour and I could go work for a chocolate company painting boxes. Afterwards, Storm lay John in the apple basket that served as a portable cradle, and they ate crayfish, pulling the long, luscious sticks of white meat from the horny legs and washing it down with the tart white Cape wine. In the darkness, the stars were stark pricks of brilliant white, and the surf boomed in long, soft, phosphorescent lines. "It's so wonderfully romantic," Storm watched it, sitting hugging her knees, and then turned her head and smiled wickedly. "And you can take that as a hint if you want to." On the rug together, she said, "Do you know what some people do?" "No, what do some people do?" Mark seemed more interested in what he was doing than the actions of the nameless somebodies. "You don't expect me to just say it out like that."
"Well, why not?"
"It's rude."
"All right, so whisper it."
So she whispered it, but she was giggling so much that he was not sure he had heard right. She repeated it, and he had heard right. He was truly stunned, so that he found himself blushing in the dark.
"Well, that's terrible," he answered huskily. "You would never do that."
However, he was over the first shock, and the idea intrigued him.
"Of course not," she whispered, and then after a silence, "unless, of course, you want to."
There was another long silence, during which Storm made some investigations.
"If I'm any judge, and I should be by now, you want to," she stated flatly.
Long afterwards, naked in the dark, they swam together out beyond the first line of breakers. The water was warm as fresh milk, and they trod water to kiss with wet, salty lips. On the beach, Mark built up the fire, and they sat close to it, cuddled together in the yellow light of the flames, and they drank the rest of the wine.
"Mark," she said at last, and there was a sadness in her voice that he had never heard before. "You've been with us 2 days now, which is 2 days too much. Tomorrow I want you to go. Go early before John and I are awake, so we don't have to watch you."
Her words struck like a lash, so that he writhed at the sting. He turned to her with a stricken face in the firelight,
What are you saying? You and John are mine. We belong together, the three of us, always.
You didn't understand a word of what I was saying, did you? She asked softly. You didn't understand when I said I must rebuild my pride, refashion my honour.
I love you, Storm. I have always loved you.
You are married to somebody else, Mark.
Oh, that doesn't mean anything, he pleaded.
Oh, yes, it does. She shook her head.
And you know it does. I'll leave Marion.
Divorce, Mark?
Yes, he was desperate. I'll ask her for a divorce.
That way we can both be truly proud. That will be a fine way for me to go to my father. Think how proud we will make him. His daughter and his son he never had, for that's the way he thinks of you. Both of them divorced. Think of baby John. How high he'll hold his head. And think of us. What a noble life we can build on the misery of the girl who was your wife.
Looking into her eyes in the firelight, he saw that her pride was iron and her stubbornness was steel. Mark dressed quietly in the dark, and when he was ready, he groped his way to the cradle and kissed his son. The child made a little whimpering sound in his sleep, and he smelt warm and milky like a newborn kitten. He thought that Storm was sleeping also as he stooped over her, but then he realized that she was lying rigidly with her face pressed into the pillow to stifle the harsh, silent sobs that convulsed her. She did not lift her face to him, and he kissed her hair and her neck. Then he straightened up and walked out into the dark. The motorcycle started at the first kick, and he wheeled it out into the lane. Storm lay in the dark and listened to the sound of the engine die away into the night. And afterwards, there was only the lonely, mournful sound of the surf and the clink of the tree frogs outside the window. Mark sat on the carved wooden stool in the sunset in front of Pungushi's hut, and he asked for the first time something that had been in his mind since their first meeting.
Pungushi, tell me of the time when the jackal pulled the Ngaga from the flooding river.
And the Zulu shrugged.
What is there to tell? I found you caught in the branches of a flooded tree on the edge of the river, and if I had sense I would have walked away, for you were clearly a very dead Ngaga, and the brown water was washing over your head.
Did you see how it was that I fell into the river?
There was a pause, while Pungushi steeled himself to admit ignorance.
It seemed to me that you had been blinded with fever and fallen into the river.
You did not see the man I killed, nor the man that fired at me with a rifle.
Pungushi covered his amazement nobly, but shook his head.
A little time before I found you in the river, I heard the sound of guns, four, perhaps five shots, from up the valley. This must have been you and the one who hunted you, but I saw no man, and the rain washed away all sign before the next morning. The floodwaters would have washed the dead man away, and the crocodiles eaten him.
They were silent again while the beer pot passed between them.
Did you see the man who fired at you? Pungushi asked.
Yes, said Mark. But my eyes were weak with fever, and as you say, it was raining. I did not see him clearly.
Hobday stood within the hall, against the wall, out of the crush of excited bodies. He stood like a rock, solid and immovable, his head lowered on the thick wrestler's neck. His eyes were hooded, as though he were able, like a great bird of prey, to draw an opaque, nicotitting membrane across them. Only his jaw made an almost imperceptible chewing motion, grinding the big flat teeth together so that the muscle in the points of his jaw bulged slightly. He was watching Dirk Courtney across the crowded hall, the way a faithful mastiff watches its master. Tall and urbane, Dirk Courtney had a warm double handshake for each of those who crowded forward to assure him of support and to wish him luck. His gaze was straight and calm, but had kept flicking back to the long counting tables. They were trestle tables that had done duty at 1,000 church socials and as many weddings. Now the scrutineers sat along them, and the last ballot boxes from the outlying areas were carried in through the front doors of the Ladyburg Church Hall.
The sprawling shape of the constituency of Ladyburg meant that some of the boxes had come in 60 miles, and although the voting had closed the previous evening, it was now an hour before noon, and no result had yet been announced. Mark crossed slowly towards where General Sean Courtney sat, pushing his way gently through the throng that lined the roped-off area around the counting tables. Mark and Marion had come in from Charker's Gate 3 days before, especially to assist at the elections. There were never enough helpers, and Marion had been completely at home, cutting sandwiches and dispensing coffee, working with 20 other women under Ruth Courtney's supervision in the kitchens behind the hall. Mark had scoured the village district with other party organisers. Like a press gang, they had hunted down missing or recalcitrant voters and brought them into the ballot stations. It had been hard work, and then none of them had slept much the previous night. The dancing and barbecue had lasted until 4 in the morning, and after that the anticipation of the announcement of the result had kept most of them from sleep. For Mark, it all had a special significance. He knew now with complete certainty that if Dirk Courtney was returned as the Member of Parliament for Ladyburg, then his dreams for Charker's Gate were doomed. As the voters had come in during the day, their hopes had seesawed up and down. Often it seemed that the end of the hall, where Dirk Courtney's organisers sat under huge posters of their candidate, was as crowded as Sean Courtney's end of the hall was deserted. When this happened, Marion's brother-in-law, Peter Botus, removed his pipe from his mouth and smirked comfortably at Mark across the length of the hall. He had become an enthusiastic supporter of Dirk Courtney's, and his circumstances had altered remarkably in the last 6 months. He had opened offices of his own on the first floor of the Ladyburg Farmers' Bank. He drove a new Packard and had moved from the cottage to a fine rambling house in 3 acres of garden and orchard, where he had insisted that Marion and Mark dine with him the previous night. "The evening star sets, the morning star rises, my dear Mark. The wise man recognises that," he had sermonised as he carved the roast. "General Courtney's star has not set yet," said Mark stubbornly. "Not yet," agreed Peter, "but when it does, you will need new friends, powerful friends." "You can always rely on us," said Marion's sister kindly. "You don't always have to live out there in the bush." "You don't understand," Mark interrupted quietly. "My life's work is out there, in the bush." "Oh, I wouldn't bank on that." Peter heaped slices of roast beef onto Mark's plate. "There are going to be changes in the Ladyburg district when Mr. Dirk Courtney takes over. Big changes. Besides, it isn't fair on poor Marion. No woman wants to live out there." "I'm quite happy wherever Mark wants to go," Marion murmured. "Don't worry," Peter assured them. "We'll look after you." And he patted Mark's shoulder in a brotherly fashion. "Mr. Dirk Courtney thinks the world of Peter," said his wife proudly. Now, as Mark crossed the hall towards General Sean Courtney, he felt the heavy, doughy feeling of dread in his guts. He did not want to bear the tidings he had for the General. Yet he knew it was better that they came gently from a friend rather than in gloating triumph from an enemy. He paused to watch Sean Courtney from a distance, feeling both pity and anger. Sean had rallied strongly since those low days in Emoyeni. His shoulders had regained some of that wide, rakish set, and his face had filled out. Some of the gaunt shadows had smoothed away. And he had been in the sun again. The skin was tanned brown against the silver of his beard and his hair. Yet he was seated now. The strain of the last few days had taxed him sorely. He sat erect on a hard-backed chair, both hands resting on the silver head of his cane. With him were many of his old friends who had gathered to give him support, and he listened seriously to his brother Garrick, who sat in the chair beside him, nodding his agreement. Mark did not want to go to him. He wanted to delay the moment. But then there was a stir across the hall. Mark saw Peter Botus scurrying across to where Dirk Courtney stood, and his face was bright scarlet with excitement. He spoke rapidly, gesticulating widely, and Dirk Courtney leaned forward to listen eagerly. Mark could not delay a moment longer. He hurried forward, and Sean saw him coming. "Well, my boy, come and sit a while. They tell me the voting is extremely close so far, but we'll have the result before noon." Then he saw Mark's face. "Well, what is it?" he demanded harshly. Mark stooped over him, his mouth almost touching the general's ear, and his voice croaked in his own ears. It's just come in on the telegraph, General. We've lost Johannesburg Central, Doornfontein and Jeppe. They were all solid, safe, smut seats. They had been South Africa Party since Union in 1910, and now they were gone. It was a disaster, a stunning catastrophe. Sean gripped Mark's forearm as if to take strength from him, and his hand shook in a gentle palsy. Across the hall they heard the wild, gloating cheers start ringing out, and Mark had to hurry. "That's not all, sir. General Smuts himself has lost his seat. The nation had rejected them. The coalition of the Labour and the National Party, under Herzog, was sweeping into power."
"My God," muttered Sean. "It's come. I didn't believe it possible."
Still gripping Mark's arm, he pulled himself to his feet.
"Help me out to the car, my boy. I don't think I can bring myself to congratulate the new member for Ladyburg."
But they were too late. The announcement came before they reached the door. It was shouted in a stentorian voice by the chief scrutineer from the platform at the end of the hall.
"Mr. Dirk Courtney, National Labour Party, 2,683 votes. General Sean Courtney, South Africa Party, 2,441 votes. I give you the new member for Ladyburg."
And Dirk Courtney leapt lightly onto the platform, clasping both hands above his head like a prize fighter.
"Well,"
there was a twisted grin on Sean's face. The skin had that greyish tone again, and his shoulders had slumped.
"So, exit the Butcher of Fordsburg."
And Mark took him out to where the rolls waited in the street.